Hello everybody and welcome to the Magical Learning Podcast for this week. This week we were lucky enough to talk to Emma Gibbons, who's an amazing person, who has a great energy, and we talk about strategic process, which is a great way to look at how you roll things out, not only with top-down approaches, but understanding how to utilize bottom-up approaches as well. It's a great conversation. It's one that Emma doesn't get to talk about too much, so it was really interesting to get such a unique insight. I hope you enjoy it and have a magical day. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Magical Learning Podcast for this week. As you can tell by the title, we do have a guest, so that's very exciting, and we'll get to them shortly. But first, let's jump around and see how our regulars are doing. So, John, how's your week going this week?
Really good, Jess. Had a great Easter. Had kids. All the kids were here for Easter, which was fantastic. Upright and breathing. I think that's a good start.
Always good. Love that, John. Danette, you are in a different location today. How are you going this week?
Yeah, good, Jez. So I've been to Melbourne and Sydney and just done a keynote for 500 students at Western Sydney Uni, which was awesome. So, and made it to the airport in time for the podcast. Super grateful and can't wait to hear from Emma.
and you are, for people that are watching the video of this, you are live at the Qantas Lounge, so live on the scene there. Love to see it. Thanks, Danette. Al, how are you going this week?
I'm going well, great. Thanks, Jez. Got school holidays and, yeah, I'm playing chauffeur at the moment, driving my children around to all their very important events.
Good stuff. Well, you got 5 stars on Uber, it sounds like, from the family.
Absolutely.
Definitely. And Graham, how are you going this week?
I'm good, Jess. Thanks for asking. Been at home all week, which is nice. Unlike Danette, I actually attempted a keynote yesterday afternoon with 2 chickens and 5 guinea fowl, but they just turned their back on me. So, you know. I've moved on.
Tough crowd, you know. It's
not getting fed, that's it. And please don't ring the RSPCA, folks. Just kidding.
They are a great crowd, actually. And people, I think, can check them out on our social media if you want to go see the amazing audience we've got there.
I'm thinking of putting a webcam up there and just feeding it live.
That's pretty good.
So, yeah. Emma's excited.
Absolutely. And Emma, how are you going this week? How's things?
If I'm being totally honest, because honest communication's important and how you going is a question we often don't answer honestly. I'm having a series of Mondays this week. Every single day this week has been Monday and Monday vibes. And so we're here. We're excited that this is over soon because it's Friday. Hanging in there.
Good job. Well, good job for hopping on the podcast then, Emma. We appreciate it.
The number of sleeps, Emma, until the next one. Just saying.
Yeah, I suffer from Monday-itis. I always am very aware of when it's coming.
Awesome. Well, Emma, we do appreciate you coming on, and we loved your topic that you suggested as well, and we'll get to those in a second. But first of all, for people that may be being introduced to you for the first time, do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So I'm Emma Gibbons, right? And I like to say I come from cold, dark places. Alaska and Minnesota is where I call home. So I've grown up in rugged weather, blizzards, negative 20 degrees Celsius, you know, all of that. And now I've been moving warmer my whole life to finally come and reside here in Perth, Western Australia on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. And I'm just so grateful for all the people who have helped my journey land here in this place. And really it feels more like the who I am, what I am, what I'm called to do is about change, right? I like to say I'm a change strategist, and the place where I operate is at the center of change, connection, and inclusion. And largely my work has been in grassroots campaigns. So that's political campaigns, union campaigns, advocacy or issue campaigns, and specializing in mobilizing people, creating people machines fueled by volunteers who are driven by their passions to go out and have conversations, advocate for change. So that's kind of my background. Now I work in the in Australia, I guess, in Australian culture, in the culture space of helping people give an authentic acknowledgement of country. Because, you know, we've heard so many acknowledgements of country with jar a bit of soulless, you know, they just read the script. And me and my mate, Reese Paddock, who's an Aboriginal man, we started this program 3 years ago, helping people connect to the words, speak from the heart and speak courageously into this space. So really, really love my work now.
Mm. And it's an amazing organization. You can check it out in the description below. I definitely would say, Emma, also you are a friend of the podcast because you know both Danette and I. So it's a very exciting to have you on. And we love the work you're doing. It's so good. And also you can definitely go check out the social media for Acknowledge This. It's great. Now,
good fun. Lots of memes.
That's it. There's a lot of memes on the social media page. Now, today you chose strategic process is what you wanted to talk about, and I thought your description was really good. But maybe tell the listeners today why you chose that, and I guess sort of like what you sort of wrote out in the description, sort of what you bring to this this strategic process.
Yeah, I'm chuckling because I swing between being a brilliant orator and a brilliant writer. And today I'm in a writer phase. So I'm like, yes, let me pull out the words that I did so well. Something that I don't get to talk about too much externally is the way I approach strategy. And of course, I learned strategy from many different voices, many different resources. So I'm an accumulation of lots of different inputs. But I think that strategy often gets either a bad rap, is misunderstood, is too heavy. It actually suffocates change. People don't understand strategy in the way that I do. So what I proposed to chat about today was my process, which is much more of an iterative, light approach to strategy and achieving change. And there's many reasons why an iterative approach is essential for the change that I work in, social change. There's many reasons why loosening your grip on the tactics and the plan actually ends up creating a better result. I don't know. I just really believe in it. I think it's really important. And I personally, over my career, got frustrated with the different systems and ways of doing things. And so this strategy has been designed in a way that makes sense to me. And I guess, I don't know if this disclaimer is important at this time, but I'm feeling called to share it, is that I have ADHD. And so I'm wondering now if that lens of how I approach strategy and keeping it light, keeping momentum, lots of review and reiteration, running tiny experiments all the time, these sort of quite momentum-based mechanisms of change is actually coming from that default frame that I have in the way my brain works and sees the world.
Yeah, and I think, that's probably a great lens to kind of look at this through as well, and I think that's a great observation. So love that, Emma. Thanks so much. So I might start the conversation with Danette. Danette, what was your question? And maybe tell us a little bit about why you chose it.
So my question, Emma, was tell us more about your strategic process and what are the benefits of it for organisations? And we should say we also had Callum McCurdy on a couple of weeks ago, sort of talking about the superpowers around what his neurodiversity was about. So I love the fact that you're bringing that lens to this as well. This is awesome. So, and I just picked it because I thought people would, as you said, people either like it or hate it or they avoid it. And I'm really curious to understand your process more.
Thank you. And this was quite fun because, again, I haven't explicitly talked about this. So my loose model, or the way I'm trying to put a container to it now, is there's sort of, it runs in a circle, right? And I think often when we develop strategy in a waterfall approach, to use a software term, but you do step one, then you do step two, and then you do step three, and so on and so forth. Whereas I use a circular model of strategy development, strategy execution. And the three phases of that are create, participate, and reiterate, right? And when you create, create a plan, create an experiment, create something, create what you're going to do. To do is to participate, to take an action, to do something in that space. And then, of course, by doing, we learn. And so that reiterate process is reviewing, taking the learnings, and then reiterating, creating a new version, V2, V3, V5, V27 of that strategy, so that you can then create that next version, participate and reiterate again. Like, it's a very circular approach. And I realize I'm saying circular approach, the pacing of that varies depending on the project, right? So the example I prepared for later had a weekly iteration because we had a 10-week campaign. It was a very, very tight timeline. My project with Acknowledge This, now 3 years running, we do a review quarterly, right? And so that's a 3-monthly pace, right? So the pace of that cycle can change depending on the project that you're in. And there's a couple of benefits that I've observed from this practice, again, whether it's come about out of necessity of how I work or if it was an intentional design. But looking back, some of the benefits are that it brings everyone along and it creates an environment where everybody's observations through the participation phase actually contribute to the creation of the next version. And that process of involving many voices and making everyone feel a sense of ownership and responsibility to that wheel of change and strategic change, that actually creates much more ownership and embeddedness within the team, right? I also think it creates, honestly, just better outcomes because you, particularly in social change, you don't know the answer. We don't know what the end result looks like. Again, the waterfall strategy of step one to step two to step 10, we don't know what step 10 looks like necessarily. We have an idea of like the values or the way we feel or the way we work together, how we interact, but we don't actually know what policy, what KPI, what the explicit outcome is. So I think that building slowly allows for that co-creation, that process of creating something entirely new that we don't expect and ultimately is a better outcome. The reason why it's a better outcome, and one of my biases in designing strategy, is to build on the energy. So in that cycle of create, participate, and reiterate, when you're reviewing, you're going to notice what things don't feel good, feel a bit stuck, are worth, like they're way more effort than they're worth. No one's having joy when they do it. Like they just feel stuck. Fail them, get them out of the way, move on. Because there's other things that are happening that are unexpected, that are beautiful, that are people are finding lots of joy, or we're getting really cool feedback about, or just something unexpected. So being aware in that, in building on the energy, building on what's working, again, creates better results. And the last benefit is one that is sort of a double-edged sword, because I find that if I do an iterative strategy, you do it once and you do it well. You do it in a way that is genuinely sustainable because it was co-designed with all the different barriers and the friction points have been reduced along the way because we've assessed and we've designed it to fit within the system. So you do it once. The double-edged sword to this is that it requires greater resourcing, greater time, a slower and more considerate pace. And that the budget or timeline of resourcing that methodology appropriately often scares people off. But I'd rather do it once. You know, my dad always said, and this is like the classic Finn, I think it came from his mom, you know, if you don't have time to do it right, you have time to do it over. And so I'm like, all right, let's just do it right and do it the way that works for everybody and make it land. So I guess that's a good introduction and starting point.
Great answer, Emma. And I was thinking, so I'm writing about adaptable leadership at the moment, and that's a really great way of adapting and creating something that people have that buy-in. So thank you for that answer. That was awesome.
And just on leaders, the gap with leaders is that they want control. And this is inherently a process which you cannot control. You do not know the outcome. You have to let all of that go and have a real humility and humble learner mindset in order to embrace this and maximize the wisdom of the whole and of everyone and going through that process. So, yeah.
Love it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Emma. Well, I might jump straight into Al's question. So, Al, what was your question and why did you pick it?
Thanks, Jez. Yeah, Emma, you've kind of answered a bit of my question already, which is what are the benefits of your strategic process compared to other systems for achieving an object or a goal?
Yeah, and I guess, and I read these two and I'm like, oh, these are very similar. Did you have any like specifics or follow-ups having heard what I just said? Or do you want me to just try again in a different way?
I guess the thing standing out for me is that your process works where it's not a clear-cut goal. There isn't an exact 10 steps to follow. And the other thing that stood out for me is, you know, letting go of control and expecting the unexpected, which to me just opens up a whole new world.
Mm. Yeah, these are sort of, you know, like the whole, I largely bucket my work in the diversity and inclusion space if we need, you know, a container for it. And it was probably like 6 years ago, right? It was really common on LinkedIn that, like, we need more diversity in boards because different voices creates different pieces of information and experiences around the table. And I feel like that was a great conversation to have, but we didn't see what that looked like in practice. We didn't actually know what that tangible outcome looked like. And so, yeah, I think just reiterating kind of that same thing you just said, by building it together, people can, it's something, again, you have to really be humble and let go of thinking you know everything and you know best. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of two magic points. There's the magic point of me, the individual, the person participating in this process, you know, within the strategic change team or one of the implementers of it, me, the person. I have my own experiences which create the lens in which I view things, but then also I have my own unique vantage point. I'm the social media manager, so I'm hearing the comments and what else is happening in socials, or I'm the volunteer manager. And so here's what people are saying on their phone calls or what they said around their, what the conversations they're having with their family at the dinner table, or I am on PR or media. These are all comms-based examples. I'm trying to think of a different example, but everybody has their own unique vantage point, right? So they're hearing different things. They're getting different data points. So that the individual is very powerful. And then, of course, there's sort of the known example of when you get many individuals together and batting new ideas around, it sparks. It creates friction and sparks and energy and new ways of thinking. Things that were unimagined come out. So I think it's a two-pronged thing, why it creates unexpected outcomes.
Yeah, I love that idea of creating the unexpected. And I guess that's kind of where my question was coming from today. I'm asking about something that I don't know about. So thank you, Emma. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thanks.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks so much, Emma. Great answer so far. It's so interesting. And I love the, I also love the energy that you're bringing as well. Like, you can see it's like inspiring something in you as well. So it makes it even easier to listen to. It's great. It's always nice when you hear that. I might throw to John now. John, what was your question and why'd you pick it?
Sorry, Emma. I guess just listening to what you've been saying, and you remind me, when I first saw you, I thought, oh, Emma the Purple Wiggle. And that's the sort of energy that you're bringing as well. Sorry.
Probably. But the credible serious, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No, all due respect.
No. We got to hold things lightly. No, that's a. I think Emma Wiggle was actually yellow, I think.
She is. She was. She's left. She's gone.
She's gone.
You got to keep up.
There's a job opening.
Obviously, they haven't caught up in Western Australia. just going off what you're saying, that, you know, part of your role is creating friction, creating sparks, opening people to different perspectives. And the question I had there was, you know, you're using an iterative process to set strategy. How much of that includes challenging the norms and the status quo and challenging people's beliefs, I guess, because we do this because this is why we've always done it. Why would we do it different?
And you'll edit this, right, Jess, if I go on tangents, right? Okay, good. It's like, because I'm laughing because my husband is wonderful. He works in government in policy, and then I'm a campaigner, right? So I'm like, burn the system, we got to do things differently, it's not working. And he's like, we have to work within the existing bureaucracy and turn the oil rig around, right? Like, so like I think you've painted that beautifully, because there is an inherent tension almost.
Absolutely.
I think the beliefs is a deeper question. On the surface level, absolutely, we challenge the status quo. I challenge the status quo in this approach. And some of the ways that plays out practically is, particularly when I was doing consulting in the community engagement space, like in infrastructure projects or whatnot, you'd have these big consulting firms coming back with a 75-page document. They're like, this is a strategy, thunk. And I'd be like, My strategy is going to be max 3 pages. It's going to be simple. Everyone will be able to repeat it. It will be known and it will be easy to execute against. That's what I'm doing. And there's this inherent tension in that, like, we assume value is like productivity is value. Look, we've put so many hours and so many graphic designers behind this. So of course it is valuable. But actually the true value in strategy is simplicity and elegance. And that's not understood and it's not valued in the same way. So I think that's absolutely a thing I have to go up against. And particularly when I was consulting externally like that with government agencies or whatnot, the problem is too, is I hand over this simple, elegant strategy and they kind of don't know what to do with it. They're like, yeah, but this isn't like a plan. And I'm like, yeah, but every plan you've had, you've told me that it doesn't work and no one follows it. So like, I'm not going to give you an Excel sheet of activity for the next 3 months. Like, you're not using it anyway. And so there's this real tension between what people say they want and how they actually work. And so I tend to build for minimum viable product. What's the thing that's going to get us going? And the action will teach us and we can continue to review and reiterate from there. The belief I considered deeply during the pandemic was productivity equals value. If I'm not doing something, if I'm not churning, if I'm not busy hustling, I am not valuable. And resetting that norm, at least within myself, to, you know, reset that rest is valuable. My relationships are valuable. I am still worthy and loved and valuable if I'm not producing something. You could tie it to capitalism. You could tie it to material. You could tie it to a lot of our systemic things in our society, particularly in the Western world. But I think that's the inherent belief maybe that I would attach it to in this moment.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree. I think the simplicity does add value because, you know, you get the 70-page report from KPMG or Deloitte or whoever they may be and makes a fantastic doorstop, but no one enacts it. So
if you've like how many local councils have you gone into and on their shelf are all of their strategic plans, none of which have been achieved, right?
Oh, they've all gathered dust.
Yeah.
Yeah. But apparently a lot of pages means a good report and you can charge a lot.
But then this is where they're like, oh, change management doesn't work or it's too hard or we couldn't possibly do it. And I'm like, you're doing it the wrong way. That's why. No one wants to do that.
No, because it sits on a shelf and doesn't get used. So, yes, that implementation of simplicity, I mean, keep things simple. Mm. But yeah, no, thank you.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, no, and it's good as well. It feels counterintuitive, but it is also obvious when you think about it. Like now you're mentioning it, it's like, yeah, that is true. Graham, I'll throw it to you. What was your question? Why'd you pick it?
Thanks, Jez. Looking back on my question, I think it just came out of my sort of default glass half empty space. But I was thinking about, and I think this was in the blurb that you sent out from Emma in the email, so sort of giving us a bit of background around the topic. And part of it, Emma was talking about the, and I apologise if I paraphrase it incorrectly, but the idea of getting, creating a space where you can gain consensus on the objective of whatever this change initiative happens to be. And I was thinking, because Danette and I have some experience in that space over the last 20 years or so, what works well for you when getting consensus isn't happening or isn't happening necessarily quickly enough? And I think you've already answered part of that, but that was my question.
No, I've prepared some specific answers for you, Graham, so I got different stuff. I am a notorious prepper. Doomsday as well. No, I'm just kidding.
In which case, actually, I have a different question entirely. No, go ahead.
No. I just really want to quickly go back to the resourcing comment I made and make a systems comment before we get into the detail. Change happens in two directions. One is top down, one is bottom up, right? Top down is easier when you say, we're doing it this way. I want these KPIs out of this. This is the objectives, make it happen. Bottom up is where we say, what do we think will work? What is working? What isn't working? What do you see? How do you want it to be designed? Let's co-create it together. Top down has been the norm for since the 80s, at least, is my sort of professional reckoning, but I'm sure it has other roots. Top-down has been the norm. And so resourcing bottom-up feels very challenging. And when you're doing co-design processes, deep engagement processes, deliberative democracy processes, like those are some of the real pointy ends of that, they take more resourcing because exactly, consensus is hard. And to achieve consensus, you have to have education, critical thinking, proper time to discuss both the logical and the emotional sides of what people are going through and making their consensus, right? Like it takes resourcing, but again, you get better outcomes, everybody's involved, et cetera. So when to achieve consensus, so now on the projects I've worked on, when I'm having a consensus point and it's not going well, or consensus is difficult to reach, there's sort of three things I wrote down. One is finding and reminding us of the common goal. And this is very much, it's really a bias as a political campaigner, but what are we here to do? Hopey, changey, yes, we can. Let's get aligned behind our mission to elect this congressperson so that we can flip the House and create some great policy in our country, right? That's a US narrative because I was mostly in the States, but you know what I mean? Like aligned around the goal. The other tool I use is alignment-based as well, but I realign us against the barrier. So we don't have funding. We're not getting the traction we want. We aren't getting the numbers we need. Okay, great. That's no one's fault. It might be in the digital space. It might be in the finance space. It's not that person's problem. It's our problem to resolve together, us realigned together against the barrier. And that's a sneaky one because people, I think, go into problem solving not realize that they're making it interpersonal rather than genuinely productive about the ideas and the project and the thing that isn't about the personal, right? And it's a sneaky one. This is one of my ironies. I definitely can attribute things personally. And I'm like, wait, no, it's not. That's us against the problem. Yeah.
I like that. So in one way, you are using a different consensus point to redirect their focus on getting consensus on the objective. And the different consensus point is the fact that we all agree that the budget's an issue or that barrier is a barrier.
Yep, exactly.
Nice.
Yeah. And yes, there is still personal responsibility, like the person who's responsible for that. Like I'm not saying you just brush those things aside, but there is a way for us to just say, okay, totally understand that the budget's tight right now. Could we all just step back from our roles? Let's take off our normal day-to-day hats and let's just get behind Tony and help him. Let's work with him and maybe brainstorm how we can address this problem together. Let's use all of our brains to get this thing solved, you know, some type of inclusive frame like that. Brilliant. The last one on consensus is questioning the scope. So when objective setting in strategy, right, what we thought the objective was back at step one might not be the objective at step five, might not be the objective at step 27. And people have a real opportunity cost letting go of what the objective is. But often it's just a tweak, right? Like it doesn't have to be a whole reset. You just have to sort of, again, assess, is the objective, is the goal that we're working towards the actual goal that is working, has the energy, and will still achieve the desired outcome. Again, it's like this humility of knowing that you might not have thought the desired outcome. You might, like having 10,000 subscribers actually isn't as important as having 100 people who are willing to go and talk to their friends and family about this, right? Like there's a tone difference in both those outcomes. Both are valid outcomes. But if you're designing for one, but the reality is another, that's going to have tension as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you. Great answer. Well prepared, well researched.
That's it.
No, I'm just kidding. This is why the writer in me is very happy that Emma prepared. Words and stuff, hey.
That's perfect for today, I guess. You've got it all prepped out, ready to go. I might jump into my question now, which is, what is a great example of this process working for you or others to show us how this works?
Yeah, cool. So I'm going to tell you a yarn about something that we all remember back in 2017, the same-sex postal survey. Do you guys remember that? Yep. Right. And it's a really lovely moment in our culture because it's a very much shared experience. Like everyone knows it, everyone participated in it. It's a really great example. So I was the WA state director for that campaign. And so starting off, and I guess quick disclaimer, like whenever I talk about this campaign, I acknowledge that it started with the Stonewall riots back in the 60s. The movement towards marriage equality was not at all won by me. I just showed up for the touchdown, right? I just showed up to doula it into the next phase, if you will. So it's absolutely not mine to own, but I'm glad I was there for that part. Now, okay, so to set the scene. So I'm asked to run this campaign. We have 10 weeks to go until postal surveys are due, right? And I have one full-time person, one part-time person who is a recent high school grad. And you know what green, brand new people to the workforce are like, you know, didn't know how to wipe his own butt, right? Sort of thing. It's like, all right, let's get going. So I'm very low resourcing. I love you. He knows who he is. We have lots of yarns about this. He's still a dear friend, but yeah. And so I had very low resourcing, almost no budget to speak of. And so how I started that off was firstly identifying the goal, which was to get the most number of yes ballots. The part of my goal setting is also recognizing my scope of influence. What can I control? All of the advertising collateral, all of the sort of stuff that people saw out and about was being run nationally. So I actually didn't have scope or control over that. And it, you know, I could have spent 10 weeks fighting that we needed better representation and ad like this for Western Australia, da 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 da. Nah, stop it. I can't control it. We only have 10 weeks. Let's do something else. So the main strategy we employed was a get out the vote strategy because the polling said that 60-ish percent of people naturally vote yes. So if we go and get people out to vote, return their ballot, we will be successful. And some of the strengths that we had that we were able to leverage in the initial design was that we had community, we had hype, we had people who were very passionate about being involved. And it's an odd strength, it's an unexpected strength, but we leaned on a positive message, right? We don't go low, we go high, as Michelle Obama said, right? You know, we always stuck to the positive, optimistic, hopeful tone, which was great because we didn't waste any time down in the mud, stuck in the trenches, right? So those are some of the strengths that we identified and explicitly named to start. What those sort of strategies, observations, goals, and strengths led to was creating a 10-week strategy that started with and largely relied on events to create momentum, right? If people love the hype, if they want to show up, if they want to post on Instagram that they were here, let's give them stuff to post about. So we held a big rally. We held a couple of smaller events. One of my favorites was Doggos for Yes, like as in everybody brought their dogs dressed up in rainbow fairy tutus. It was chaos and it was amazing, right? But like just fun, just hype, getting people to show up. And so, yes, we created a schedule of events. I remember it's still burned in my memory, just on the wall, you know, and like, all right, this is 10 weeks, no time at all, let's go. And so using that gathering that community as a strength. As I said, we had weekly revisions of this strategy, weekly checking ins. Some of the key moments I remember that sort of adapted our strategy was when we realized we had crossbench political support. So I think it was early on, like week two or so, and I realized we had Liberal, Labor, Greens, even like the First Nations, Liberal Democrats, like we had all these politicians coming out of the woodwork in WA who wanted to demonstrate their support and lend something. And I was like, whoa, I've never been on a campaign where the crossbench has come together. This is cool. And we were able to leverage that for a number of things, including financing, free radio placements, free printing, free lots and lots of material support that we didn't get from that national campaign, right? So we were almost able to leverage the existing infrastructure of all those political parties to create assets here that were relevant to Western Australia. WA says yes. That was our little, you know, coalition over here. And then the other big one I remember is about 4 weeks into the campaign, maybe it was week five or so, traditional activities during a campaign include phone banking and door knocking, right? You've probably had someone ring you or someone rock up to your door. Maybe not if you're in the country, but you get my gist. And what we realized is that our data wasn't sophisticated enough to do that effectively. Like if you would go door knocking, we did one door knocking shift the entire campaign basically. And everybody came back from that shift and was like, everybody was already voting yes, or nobody was home. I didn't feel like it was a good use of my time, et cetera, right? We just got immediate feedback and immediately failed that. We're like, great, no more door knocking. Doors are not a thing. Great, it's not happening this campaign. So instead, we then leveraged phones and we ran a lot of phone banks through certainly the lists that we were provided, but we also did some clever phone banks with university students where we just had them call 10 of their friends. Right. And after we abandoned door knocking and some of that direct voter to voter outreach, we adopted a new grassroots strategy or message of just talk to three friends. All you got to do is just talk to three people. And that went across our digital, our in-person conversations, our events, because we figured in Western Australia, it's only 2.5 million of us. Surely we only have 2 degrees of communication. If everybody just talks to somebody, we'll be fine. And so by assessing what was working, what wasn't working, we were able to then find a message that did work for us, for our community, and in the space that we work in, but also then to achieve the goal. We also leveraged SMS and other digital communication tools in that same vein. So again, that shift of abandoning what traditional campaign activity was, abandon it and instead adopt a completely organic approach, was going against the status quo. It was different, but it all worked out really well. And I'm very proud of WA because in the early polling, like in like July-ish that year, again, the postal survey was due about November 11th, I think. In early polling, WA was polling second to the bottom, right? We were really, really low on the supporting yes. And through our campaign, we actually ended up being the second highest state behind Victoria. And that's just so cool. Oh, bye, Al. Nice to meet you. See you later. And that was just such an incredible, like, you know, example of community building, listening to the community, listening to what's working, and building and iterating in that way. I just remember, sorry, one other data point that influenced our message was one of our key volunteers came in one day and he said, and he's like, maybe like a 18-year-old or so, 16-year-old maybe. And he was like, over the weekend, I went down south to visit my family and I had some really difficult conversations with my grandma. And it was weird and hard and let's talk about it. And then I was like, oh my gosh, family conversations. This is going to happen around dinner tables. So talk to three people, simple message. Anyway, so yeah, so that worked out. That's a bit of an example. I can say more, I can say less. Well, does that satisfy your...
that was great. And I think it's also a great example of like the sort of bottom-up approach, especially with specifically that door knocking campaign where you tried it once and you went, you know what, this is just, we're going to get rid of that straight away. And I think that's a great way to kind of look at this. I think you might be able to, I guess, let's jump into Kanika's question and then we'll have time to wrap up as well, which is, I guess, Kanika's asked, how can we apply this thinking to ongoing social change? So I guess like this is a question about sort of going forward, how can people sort of just apply this and specifically in the social change area?
A great question. It's one I ponder often and we only have so much time, but I think social change is led by individuals at the margins, right? And what I would hope is that for social change, the ideas that you can take forth into social change is that you yourself have power. You have power to act, you have power to create change. And if you've tried something before and it didn't work, try again. Right? There's all kinds of actions, big and small, that create change, all kinds of different strategies we can use. And so you as an individual have power and personal responsibility to participate in social change, and give yourself the grace to create, participate, and reiterate. Be like, you know what? That didn't work. I'm going to try something else. And then I guess for ongoing organizations, like if we're talking larger than just individual, embracing this process of change is really rewarding and helpful. Definitely do it. The one thing I always impress onto organizations or people working in social change campaigns is to remember to celebrate the wins, right? Because like, for example, I'm working in the space of reconciliation right now. Reconciliation, while we have a giant milestone later this year with a referendum, it's not done at that point. Like, this is long 10, 15 year, like, big systemic work, right? Big culture change work. It just doesn't happen overnight. So finding those ways to celebrate the wins at those milestones. And perhaps this is why the reiteration process is so helpful, because you can note what worked well. Let's celebrate the wins. Let's build on the win, you know? So I think keeping that lightness, that joy, I've seen so many campaigns with good intentions collapse because they've suffocated themselves. And they've taken all the joy, all the fun, they're burdened by process, they're doing things they don't think works, people's good intentions aren't being channeled in the right way. So yeah, that was a bit of a rant, but a lot of things I believe.
Yeah, no, I mean, amazing. And this whole conversation has been so eye-opening. I've loved it. It's definitely sparked in my mind when I'm trying to do projects, how to think about them, and when I'm involving other people, you know. So that's definitely helped me. But I'm going to go around the room now and just get some final thoughts from people. So I'll start with you, John. Any final thoughts on today's conversation or strategic process?
No, thank you, Emma. It's been really good talking to you and hearing you talk as well. I guess a couple of things that I've taken away is, you know, that constant celebrate the wins, because, like, I work in government and I do IT project management, but we don't celebrate the wins. We move straight on to the next thing to, you know, take the lessons that we learnt and relearn them again. So, yeah, we need to take time to celebrate the wins, keep the fun and the joy in what we do and what we're doing. So, you know, to me, they're a simple message that we need to take on board.
One of the you sparked in me, one of the tools I use I worked with software engineers for a number of years. That's why I'm like, oh, hey, what's up? I get a little corner of your space, not a ton. But the method I use, this simple positives, negatives, and deltas, you know, what's working, what's not working, and what do we do to change it. It's a classic, it's not mine, it's somebody else's, but, like, just using that as part of that review, reiteration, and then designing again, so that we don't relearn the same lessons. Like, when you said that, my heart fell, and I'm like, oh man, imagine the wasted time and effort. Hey, so that's just a simple framework I use for those sessions.
Yeah, well, we do relearn a lot. Kind of.
I love that. Thanks, John. Danette, I'll go to you now. Any final thoughts on today's conversation or strategic process?
But Emma, I loved your model. Gorgeous model, and I love that whole reiterative approach to it. And I really like that bit about the humility as well, because it's really difficult to move forward if you're not open to what you don't know, what others can bring to the table and stuff. So awesome conversation. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Danette. Graham, I'll throw to you. Any final thoughts on today's conversation or strategic process?
Yeah, Emma, it's been amazing. So thank you. I have a page full of notes. I just picking up on the thing that stood out second most was the purple wiggle opportunity. I think you should, in fact, if any of the other wiggles are listening at the moment, make the call, do the right thing. I love the, you know, dig in on the positive energy. So where we have energy in any part of that process, let's leverage that. That's because I love that, the idea of watching change initiatives suffocate because we don't do that. Action teaches us was also just a zinger for me. It's like, well, of course it does. If we choose to pay attention to what's happening during and after the action.
People get so hung up on, like, no, we have to know what's going to happen. We have to do the process. We have to do the risk mitigation. Yep. Where's the document before we act? And it's like, you're not going to know most of those answers until you get going.
Yeah. Or until you get to page 463 of the consultant's report. Love it. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Graham. And Emma, any final thoughts you wanted to have on today's conversation or strategic process?
I didn't prepare this answer. No, I'm just kidding.
Gotcha.
No, I've said a lot of things. I think you'll take what's useful. I guess, yeah, I'm always a call to action, I suppose, is where my natural ending often lies as a campaigner. And so I guess I'd encourage you, as you said, you've heard some great reflections of the bits or the zingers that people are taking forward. And just a reminder to you to take the things forward that really resonate with you, put them into action, put them into practice. And it's going to feel uncomfortable. Going against the status quo, doing something different. It's going to be at times maybe difficult to make that case, get people to listen to you as to why we got to do it this way. But I'd encourage you to go forth courageously. And I define courage as having fear and taking a step anyway. So if you're afraid that nobody's going to listen or nobody's going to take you seriously after you've pitched this idea, or afraid it won't work, you've wasted all this effort, have a bit of courage, take a step anyway, get going.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Now, Emma, just before we go, is there anywhere that you would like people to, if they want to come find more information about
you? Yeah, come hang out. Yeah. Let's do it. My website, emmagibbons.com, G-I-B-B-E-N-S, acknowledgethis.com.au. I'm on Instagram at Emma Da Gemma, which is going to be too hard because it's just a nickname from when I was a kid. So just go find it from my website.
You know what? I'll put all the links in the description so you don't even need to go find it. It'll be nice and easy to click on. Emma, thank you so much for being on. This has been a great conversation. I've also taken a bunch of notes, so thank you so much for being on. To our team, thanks as always. Great questions. And to people that are listening, wondering where Al went, he just had to disappear towards the end there, so don't worry. he'll be back next week. And to everybody listening, keep sharing it and have a magical week.